Back on Downtown, time for Sports Lit 101. Our next guest is the author of a number of books, including 1962, Baseball and America in the Time of JFK, and his terrific new one, Do You Believe in Magic? Baseball and America in the Groundbreaking Year of 1966. Happy to welcome David Krell back to the program. David, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
Great to have you back with us. And well, let me just say, you've done it again, my friend. Another absolutely wonderful book at baseball and what was happening in the country in this important year.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
So, what drew you? You had the great success with 1962 and a truly watershed year. Why, of all those other years, why 66?
Well, I think we had talked about this the last time when you had me as a guest to talk about 1962. It hadn't been done. I couldn't find any books about 1966 except for one book about the World Series called Black and Blue. And I thought there must be some other things going on that year in baseball, not to mention the country at large. And when I did a little digging, I found Caesar's Palace debuted. I found some stories about Batman that I didn't know before. And there was just an abundance, and the embarrassment really came from, okay, Big Shot, you have all these topics. Now, how are you going to string them together? And what are you going to leave out? Because as we talked about before, your darlings will be thrown overboard. If I wrote the book I wanted to write, it would have been 700 pages.
One of the things that I think you did tremendously well is distill this down into very readable and very understandable prose without sacrificing the importance of anything. And that's not easy to do. I mean, I've read a lot of books that are just so wordy and verbose that you don't get that. When you did that, you also managed to do it without making it sound like bullets. So when you sat down to do this, did you do a lot of outlining? Because I know I never do. Did you do a lot of outlining and organization that way?
I did a lot of outlining, Rich, but I also know that I'm going to be sitting before you, before others who are discerning and don't want to have their time wasted and don't want to see in a book what you can find on Wikipedia. So I always had that in my mind. What are you going to talk about? Are you going to talk about Gene Autry, who owned the Angels? Or are you going to talk about Jack Dutton, the city councilman who actually got the facility to be approved, the ballpark? And why did he get it approved? And what was it about him that drove him? What was the ambition? What did he want? Well, he wanted civic service. And I wanted to tell that story. And I wanted to tell the other stories, that these unsung heroes. Why was 1966 such a groundbreaking year? And there was a lot of outlining, but you have to leave yourself open for new avenues, because I think it was Patton who said, when you go into war, a battle plan is great until somebody shoots at you.
Yeah, right. One of the things I thought was really interesting about 1966, the Dodgers and the Yankees are starting to go into a period of decline, and they've been big time. Baltimore was not the place that people, I think, expected the next World Series champion to come from, because they had some... But they had some of the most colorful people and players in that period of time, going up to the great year where they had the 420 game winners. And in that, is there something, did you find something particularly compelling in the fact that it was the Orioles?
Not per se, but I did not realize until I was about halfway through, these teams are transplants. The Dodgers came from Brooklyn, and the Orioles came from St. Louis in the early 50s. They were once the Browns.
Right.
So it was very new still in 1966 to have a major league team in these cities.
And you, one of the things I think was also interesting is the way that what is changing socially in America at the time, and especially when you, about all the music you talked about in the different TV shows and things, you got Johnny Carson starts, Andy Griffith, you got Batman, you've got shows dedicated to like I Spy and Man from U.N.C.L.E. and those kinds of things coming along in that era. Sports, baseball is still the number one sport then. And it has to compete with all these other things. Why do you think baseball stayed so compelling in the late 60s?
I think you still had parents and grandparents who were immigrants who wanted to grasp the American dream. And what better way than to go to the ballpark? That's why Italian Americans called Babe Ruth the Bambino. You know, it's Italian for Babe. And it was just ingrained. Television hadn't taken hold for sports yet. Football was certainly on the rise. And then by the time you get to the 80s and 90s, basketball and football pretty much took over. But baseball is still the American sport.
We're talking with David Krell about his new book, Do You Believe in Magic? Well, 1962 was, of course, John Glenn's first orbital flight on Friendship 7. I would say, other than 1969 and the moon landing, 1966 was perhaps as important a year for the space program as any other year in the decade.
Oh, no doubt. They had five successful missions, and someday someone will write a book about the Gemini project. It gets overlooked. We had the right stuff with Project Mercury, and everybody knows about Neil Armstrong landing on the moon, first man to land on the moon in Apollo 11. But sandwiched in between are these two-man trips. And gosh, that was so imperative for us to get to the moon. Every trip got us more information, got us closer to the point where we could send up three-man missions and have one land on the moon.
One of the things that changed in that time, too, is Marvin Miller comes into the picture in baseball. And Koufax and Drysdale are the first big stars to say, well, you don't pay me, I'm not going to play.
Right.
You've got still the Curt Flood thing going on and the like.
Right.
How much do you think Marvin Miller's getting that job changed all the professional sports?
Over time, great deal of change because of Marvin Miller. But at the time, and I wrote about this, he wasn't universally accepted by the players, especially veterans, because you have a veteran ball player for 10, 12 years. He says, well, I have a great relationship with the owner. You're going to come in, you're going to act like a crybaby, and you're going to spoil it. And I need to put food on the table. But what Marvin Miller did was he went on a listening tour. He went and listened to the ball players. What's your quality of life? What happens when you're on a 9-game road trip? Do you come back home and play that night? Things like that are more important than money sometimes because it really affects the longevity of the player. Koufax and Drysdale, that holdout was separate from Miller. You know, it happened roughly the same time as Miller got the job as the union chief, but Koufax and Drysdale, the holdout I had heard of, I didn't realize that it lasted for a month.
One of the other big factors in baseball in the 1960s was the movement of franchises, whether it was expansion in 62 or, as happened in 1966, the arrival of the Braves from Milwaukee to Atlanta. And it seems clear that what we think of and what for many years was called the New South, a big part of that was the success of this baseball team moving to Atlanta.
And wouldn't you know that the Hawks and the Falcons come about around the same time, and that solidifies Atlanta as a major metropolis. Mm. Of course, Wisconsinites were heartbroken when the Braves left, but the lawsuit happened to no avail. But 4 years later, they got a team when the Seattle Pilots busted after one season in Washington State, and they moved to Wisconsin and became the Brewers.
When you look at baseball as a TV entity in the 1960s versus today, do you think it was more in tune with the times? That the announcers were more in tune with the times?
Well, it was more romantic. It was more, as Brad Pitt says, who says you can't be romantic about baseball? There was something very cool about kids bringing a transistor radio to school and listening on the way home and running home, hoping you'll catch the last two innings of the game. Now it's all prime time. Kids can't stay up that late. Adults can't stay up that late in many cases to watch the World Series. And I think we've lost a lot of that. But also, don't forget, Bruce and Rich, there were no playoffs then.
Right.
You didn't have this extended postseason that we have now, which it just goes on and it's interminable. So you really had the top two teams battling it out.
And I wasn't aware. I was just a young kid at the time, but was certainly following baseball. But Frank Robinson, he took that trade from Cincinnati pretty personally, didn't he?
Well, the Cincinnati executive called him over the hill in not so many words. And wouldn't you know, Frank Robinson wins the Triple Crown in Baltimore. So he proved that age is just a number, and he's as much an icon to Cincinnati baseball fans as he is to Baltimore fans.
Yeah, that executive was the Dan Duquette of his era, saying that Roger Clemens was a pitcher of diminishing skills.
Or the guy from Decca Records who told the Beatles guitar groups are on the way out.
Yeah, guitar groups are on the way out, absolutely. One of the things you talk about in the book, and I knew about it, but I had never really studied it, and I did, is Ted Williams' remarkable speech at Cooperstown.
Oh, yeah.
I can't think of any speech by a sports figure of his magnitude that could have had more of an impact on his game and his Hall of Fame.
Well, there were people in entertainment who made great strides. Jack Benny is a favorite of mine. And certainly he gave Eddie Rochester Anderson all the great lines in the show. Because Jack Benny said, as long as somebody laughs, it doesn't matter whether I get the line or Rochester gets the line. And Rochester often bested him. But with Ted Williams using not only his celebrity, but his day. This was his induction day at the Hall of Fame. This wasn't some interview he did for the Boston Globe. He shone the spotlight on the Negro Leaguers who just didn't have the opportunity to play. And Ted Williams and people like him said, look, the guy can play ball. He shouldn't be punished because he wasn't allowed to be in the major leagues. Josh Gibson should be here. Satchel Paige should be here. And there are a few dozen others that he probably didn't have time to name in his speech. But had he not done that, I wonder how much longer it would have taken. It took until 1971 until Satchel Paige got inducted. And even then, the commissioner of baseball said, no, it'll be an exhibit, until he succumbed and Satchel Paige is right up there with everyone else.
A lot of music in that period of time. We get the freeform FM radio comes into being especially in greater New York, where I was listening at the time, where you'd hear Take Five one moment, a Beatles tune the next, a Dylan tune the next, and then some wild band from the coast. There was that much out there, there was so much stimuli going on. Do you think that had a lot to do with the energy of the era?
From what I'm told, yes. I was born in 67, so when I listen to these songs, it's pretty much on the oldies channel. But you had Motown, folk, hard rock, the surfing sound, or some people call it the California sound. Classical music, wasn't there a number one hit, Love is Blue?
Yep.
Which is sort of classical. So there's a lot of moving parts in the music arena. It must have been a great time to grow up in.
I was 15 then, and it was a pretty good year, as I remember.
And when you talk about television, too, as you mentioned in the book, the spies, whether it was most of them spinning off the success at the movies of the James Bond franchise, but they did such an interesting job of talking about other things that were happening in America and the world. You mentioned The Man from U.N.C.L.E., the cooperation behind the scenes of the United States and the Soviet Union with Napoleon Solo and Ilya Kuryakin working together. The parody of the spy genre with Get Smart and others. And then the wonderful work, and I was so happy to see you write about Barbara Bain and the tremendous job she did on Mission Impossible and the unique way they found to light her.
Barbara is an angel. She gave me so much time, so much information, so much background about Mission Impossible, remembered things like they happened yesterday, and pointed to the fact of, yeah, it's the crew. It's not just the actors. The crew decides how to light, the sound, everything. So when you see a movie, when you see a TV show, believe me, it's the lighting and the sound guys who really deserve an unsung hero's credit. She was tremendous. And what a breakthrough for a woman to have that role where she's on an even keel with the rest of the team.
Absolutely. So when you look at baseball, David, did 1966, other than the end of a great career with Sandy Koufax, did it mark a turning point in baseball history?
Well, sure, because when Sandy Koufax leaves, what happens? All the GMs across the National League are crying, same way they were crying during the holdout, because if there's no Sandy Koufax visiting your city, that means a lot less people in the stands. It wasn't just the Dodgers who were crying about that. It was a turning point. The Dodgers didn't get back to the series until 74. They got swept by Baltimore in 66. And Drysdale had, I think, three more years. I believe he retired after 69, after which he made an iconic guest appearance on the Brady Bunch, where he showed Brady his secret slider, one of my favorite episodes of all time. And as you said, the Yankees were in quite a downturn. After the 64 World Series, they didn't get back until 76. So New York was suffering in the American League. In the National League, of course, once Tom Seaver came in and Gil Hodges became the manager, the Mets had some really good fortunes.
Yeah, and the Mets are an interesting thing, too, because we're talking expansion, teams that have been relocated, venerated, long-established teams falling off. It had to expand the interest in baseball, as well as certainly, obviously, Atlanta getting a franchise did. I asked my students the other day what team they thought broadcast into the most states in my hockey lit class. And they were all suggesting New York or Chicago or something. I said, well, how about Atlanta? Because what southern states also have baseball teams? And they're like, ooh, only Florida. You know, that really opened up a lot.
I took a couple of classes with Dr. Douglas Gomery at the University of Maryland in media. I was a media studies major. And he talked about how the most popular baseball team in Fargo, North Dakota, it's Fargo, North Dakota, right? Not South Dakota.
North Dakota.
Actually, anywhere from Seattle to Milwaukee and Minneapolis, that whole area, the most popular team was the Braves because they had the Superstation.
Right.
That's the only baseball they saw except for maybe college baseball. So TBS, the Superstation, because of Ted Turner, was able to build a following in states that were 1,000 miles away.
Another big thing happened then, the Miranda decision. And I'd argue that that's been probably as important in law as almost anything that follows right after that until maybe Title IX. Everybody seems to know, they've heard it said on TV, but how many people really know the story behind the Miranda decision?
Right. And I just saw a comment on YouTube that the end of the Shawshank Redemption, which I believe happens in 66, there's a cop reading the prison guard his rights off a card. And that's because they didn't know it by heart then.
Mm.
They had to recite it word for word. And sure, by the time you're 10 years old and you've seen any cop show, you can pretty much recite the Miranda warnings. But I felt it incumbent upon me. I was a lawyer. I graduated from Villanova Law School. I'm a University of Maryland graduate. And I felt it incumbent upon me, given my legal background, to explore the Miranda case and talk about it.
And you, the Care For, can also understand the labor negotiations and things in a different way from the layman. I gave my copy of your book to my son, who's a lawyer, and I know he's going to enjoy a lot of that part of the book.
And interesting, too, that I, as a civics teacher for a long time, always talked about two cases that happened within, about a year of each other. And one was Gideon versus Wainwright, with Clarence Earl Gideon being convicted down in Florida when he was told he could represent himself in court, even though I think he had only about an eighth grade education, got a new trial, was found not guilty. But Ernesto Miranda got himself a new trial, but then was found guilty a second time. Well, it's a wonderful book. It is really a remarkable story of America. It's yes, it's a baseball book, so more than that, and it really weaves together everything that was happening in this country in 1966. So, David, congratulations on another terrific read. Amen. It's great to have you back with us, and well, we look forward to the next adventure you take us on.
Thank you so much. I do appreciate it.
Thank you so much, David, and let us know as soon as you got a new book. We'd love to talk to you again.
Next year, I have a book coming out about the cultural history of the Red Sox.
Touchdown. Can't wait to have you.
Awesome. Thank you, David.
Bye now.
Take care.
David Krell, the book is Do You Believe in Magic? Baseball in America in the groundbreaking year of 1966.